Very good. You know, over in Perth, when we do these sthanas, we usually have the Sangha first, and then the eight preceptors. And after the eight preceptors, we invite the seven preceptors, and that's followed by the six preceptors, the five preceptors. And then the four preceptors come next, the three preceptors after the four preceptors, then the two preceptors, the one preceptors. And if you don't have one precept, get out of here, you don't belong. The no preceptors don't get to eat. Very good. So it's a talk this morning. Any suggestions what you want me to talk about? Silence. That's a very good topic to talk about. Okay, that's a good one. Silence, yes. Silence. They always say that silence is golden. And as the dollar goes down, sometimes the price of gold goes up. And so silence is actually more valuable than it was when I was young. Because it's true that we do always talk far too much. And if we can keep more silence in our life, we get into far less trouble. Especially that when you have an argument, there is a lovely little behavioral pattern which I always like to do, is if anybody ever scolds you, if ever they look you in the eye and they give you a roasting with their mouth and say, you're stupid, you're an idiot, you're bad, you're terrible, then instead of arguing back at them straight away, instead of standing up for yourself and you talk this about me, let me tell you about you, or that's unfair, it's always great to give the 10 second of silence after you just received a scolding. The reason is because they expect you to actually to speak next. But when you don't say anything, the only thing they can be mindful of is what they've just said to you. It gives them the opportunity to actually to hear what they've just said and to reflect just on how uncivilized was their behavior. If you don't give them that 10 second of silence after they've just scolded you, they don't realize that what they've just done is very, very unwholesome, unskillful, unkind, and just basically not really sort of what a human being should do to another human being. So the 10 second of silence when people scolding you gives them the opportunity to reflect on their very unskillful behavior so they don't need to do it anymore. And it also puts you in control of the situation. So you don't get sucked into getting more anger. They get angry at you and yeah. And we tend to get into this big argument and it's very unpleasant. So 10 seconds of silence is a beautiful way of remembering the Buddha's teachings about having the space to reflect upon things. And that's also the same in all the problems and difficulties which you all face in your life. And why after breakfast, why after I finished here, after lunch, any spare time, there's lots of people always queue up to ask about their problems. And I want an easy life. I need my rest. And so because of that, I like to answer everyone's problems all in one go. So that I'm free and nice and peaceful. So, you know, it's like that. At the end of a talk, you know, we ask any questions. It's important to actually have the opportunity to ask questions in the Dhamma. Anyone got any questions? And everyone is silent. So no more questions. Okay, we can finish. Finish? No way. There's a whole line of people with their questions. And it's all the same question. If you could only ask it sort of in public, then I could answer it for everybody. It's much more efficient. But all of those problems in life all come because we think too much and we're silent too little. All the great wisdom which I have does not come from reading books, does not come to listening to other people give Dhamma talks, because I don't get the chance anymore. Everyone has to listen to me. So all the wisdom which I get comes from silence. putting some space between the thoughts. But it's so difficult to get that silence these days. And so one of the ways of getting that silence, which I have been encouraging people to do, is we live far too much in our thinking mind, thought, thought, thought. We need to get out into the real world. And the real world, I mean the real world of the cold and the heat and the rain and into nature. Because recently, we had a conference over in Perth, and then somebody was saying, this psychologist, a new type of therapy, and all these psychologists with new types of therapy, they're obvious therapies, and you don't actually need a psychologist to tell you about this. And he called it nature therapy. And all it was, if anyone was depressed, upset, anger, having difficulties, psychosis, I don't know what it was, but it worked for so many mental diseases, is just take them in the car and go out to the bush, go into the mountains, go into a forest, go to the beach or the coastline, and get out into the beauty of nature. Sometimes it's quite hard nature, the cold, the heat, the wind. Take off all of your blankets and put away all your umbrellas. Get wet, just like you did when you were a kid. Take off your shoes and get the mud between your toes. Feel the wind on your face. Don't cover up. Feel it. Become alive in nature. Because those feelings in your body are just so strong, you can't think anymore. The feelings take over. Now, if you can't go out into the city, just go and stand under the shower. And not soaping up, not in a rush, and just feel the water on your body. Now, get into the present moment. Start to feel. And then that helps stop all the thinking stuff which goes on in the head. It gives you the ability just to appreciate that some of the best things in life happen when you're not thinking, that you're actually feeling, you're knowing. And one of the great benefits of becoming aware and alert to your body is that, that many of those feelings you can't put a name to. I always like asking people, right now you're sitting on the floor or you're sitting on the chair, how does your bottom feel pressed against a chair? It's called the bottom feeling. But we haven't got a word for that. So you can feel it, but you can't name it, which I think is marvelous. It means you're getting into physical feelings and it stops you thinking, because once there's a thought, a name, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And because of all that thinking, we've got addicted to thoughts these days. And because of that, it means we don't live in the real world. We live in the world of thoughts. Now, sometimes people say that to me, Ajahn Brahm, it's all very well for you to talk about all these things, but you don't have a wife and kids. You don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. You don't have to pay tax. You don't. He said, Ajahn Brahm, you don't live in the real world, I said. And when they say things like that to me, I say, who lives in the real world? How many people here dye their hair? That's not real. How many people wear makeup and deodorant? That's not the real world. The real world is smelly. How many of you have air cons and heaters? How many of you drive in the car, so sometimes you're air conned or heated on the way to work, you quickly jump out, go in the office, and that also is hermetically sealed from the real world. How many of you, have all these things which make you look like something you're not? How many of you use Botox to get rid of the lines in your face? I don't. I don't. So who lives in the real world? Sometimes what you take to be the real world is just fake. It's just protected. It isn't real at all. And so sometimes I like to say, what is the real world? I mean, go into that real world. Not the thought, the fantasy world, but the real world. the real world where you can feel cold, you can feel heat. Because I was in Singapore recently, and there was an article in the newspaper there, because everybody in Singapore, there's a few Singaporeans here today, everyone in Singapore, the men have to do 2 years mandatory service in the military service. You've got no choice in the matter, you have to. And so, there was an article was this, when the new recruits, they have to go, you know, on camp, sleeping in tents. And the first night they're sleeping in tents, where's the aircon? There's no aircon in a tent, sleeping in the jungle. This is military. But they're so unused to any place which hasn't got aircon that they really suffer a lot the first few days until they get used to it. And so the body can adapt when you don't have aircon. My body is very adaptable. So much so that recently when I was in, in Korea. I went to Korea in March for a big event, and it was up in the mountains. And they took us to the top of the mountain to do a holy walk with the TV cameras. And it was minus 15 degrees centigrade. Minus 15. And the snow was this thick. Not like in Melbourne. If you ever get any snow, it's like Mickey Mouse snow. Not the real stuff, really thick stuff. And the big snow. And so I went for my walk. This is all I wore, just what I wore here. Just my sandals and my bare feet. No socks. And I say, how can you do that? I said, easy, it's just reality. It's world. You get a little bit cold, but you know, you just be with the cold. You don't complain about it. And so there I was walking. All the cameras, I could see them. They weren't looking at me or the other monk at all. They were all pointed to my feet. My feet became very famous in South Korea. Miracle feet, which don't feel the cold. Because all it really is actually becoming real to the world and not trying to escape from it, accepting it. In fact, it would be accurate to say there'd be something very wrong with you if you've never been sick. So for me, I don't like stigmatizing sickness. I like people saying when they go to see the doctor because they've got a fever or they've got a broken leg or they've got some other irritation inside of them somewhere, they should go to that doctor and say, "Doctor, there is something right with me. I got the flu again." Now, okay, it starts off with a joke, but there's something really important in that. Because when we realize that sickness is nothing to be ashamed of, you haven't done anything wrong when you're sick, when you've got a cancer, when you've got some other disease. When you take away the stigma of sickness, number one, you go and see the doctor much quicker. You won't hide it so much. You won't think that somehow or other this made a big mistake in your life. I'm sick, oh, what did I do? You know, that happened to me once. I don't know what had happened to me. When was the last time I was sick? It was about, when I was 17, right? So that's about 25 years ago. No, yeah, 25 years ago was the last time I was sick. Went to see the doctor. And I was sitting in the surgery like you usually are, waiting for your appointment. And one of my friends came in, one of the people who listens to my talks, and then saw me sitting in the surgery, waiting to see the doctor. And he took one look at me and said, "I never expected to see you in a place like this." I'm supposed to be a meditation teacher, supposed to be a healthy person, a healthy lifestyle, no stress. And there I was in the doctor's. I felt really guilty. As if he caught me in a brothel or in a pub or somewhere. It's okay to be sick. Even monks can be sick. Even doctors can be sick. But why is it we stigmatize sickness? Because we're not real. The real world is we get sick from time to time. Welcome to the real world. We accept it. And actually we learn from it. Being sick has got many advantages to it. Number one, if you are sick, then you become a field of merit to your family. Because they said, you know, looking after the sick, the Buddha said, is like looking after the Buddha. So, if you're sick, in hospital, tell your husband, darling, I'm sick, this is your opportunity to make some good karma for once in your life, darling. Pamper me. Look after me. And you know, it is a privilege to look after someone who's sick. If they are sick, you know, it's great. You know, you can actually do something for them. I remember this monk. This monk, he was from Chicago. And you know, mothers would understand this. He was in Chicago, and it's a very cold city sometimes. And it was a winter time. It was icy. He slipped on the ice as a monk and broke his leg. And so, you know, had to call the ambulance, go to the hospital, you know, get the cast on. And then they called the mother. And when the mother came, he told me this story, when the mother came into the ward, the bedroom, and saw her son, you know, in a big plaster cast, just broken his leg, his mother gave one of the biggest smiles of her life. And the son, the monk, said, why are you smiling so much? I've just broken my leg. Haven't you got any compassion for me? And the mother said with great glee and joy, and he said, you've been over Thailand, now being a monk. Now you've got your leg broken. You're in hospital. Now I've got you, son, exactly where I want you. You can't run away. And I can mother you for the next couple of weeks. Because mothers enjoy looking after their children. Okay, they prefer their legs not to be broken, but it's either get your son to go back overseas or have him here with his leg broken. Okay, we'll take the leg broken. Because people enjoy being kind to other people. And so if you're really sick, it's a great opportunity for others to look after you. So don't ever feel guilty about being sick. Next time you are sick and you have to stay home for a few days, tell all your family. Ajahn Brahm said this is a great opportunity for you to develop your Buddhist practice of compassion and kindness and service to me. Here I am. And if they really understand, actually, they'll say, yes, thank you so much. Because it is a great joy to pamper someone, look after them, give them a breakfast in bed or something. What do you really like to eat? Even like on Mother's Day. What happened to you on Mother's Day last week? Did your children come and pamper you? I hope they did. Although these couple of kids say, it wasn't Mother's Day. They said, it was Sunday. And I was a son. They should have been pampering me. It was Sunday. We don't have daughter day. That's not fair, isn't it? We only have Sunday, never daughter day. So anyway, it's nice to have the opportunity to pamper someone else. Of course, you know, everybody says this, that to give and care for other people is one of the greatest happinesses and joys of a human life, to care for somebody else and to give them, look after them. That's one of the problems for me. I do apologize to everyone here that I'm far too healthy. I don't get sick enough, which means you can't pamper me enough. It's true, because sometimes, you know, I did cough. That's the only thing. I sometimes have allergies, and sometimes I remember coughing once, just like that, exactly. I had a cough, and I coughed once, and before the talk had finished, I saw a few people go out. They'd gone to the chemist shop and got me all this medication. And they came up to me after, I saw you cough, Ajahn Brahm, so you must take this. It really helped me, echinacea or something. It's really good stuff for you, and get rid of your cough. And the next person said, no, don't take that. Take this medicine. This is much better. You have to take this. This is like herbal. No, this is Ayurvedic. No, this is homeopathic. No, this is allopathic. No, don't do that. Just keep it just like a bit of, lemon and honey. That's very good for you. No, don't do that. And in 10 minutes, I had all this line of medicine in front of me. And out of compassion, because, you know, people want to help. You know, you can't say, no, I don't want to. You have to keep it there. And they look at you with these big eyes. You will take it, won't you? Please. And being stupid, I say, okay, I'll take it. And I do have to keep my promises. So I take all this medicine. And then I'm really sick. So, So but, yes, people are kind and nice, so you take, you don't mind being sick for people because it gives them happiness. So you don't stigmatize sickness. It's okay to be sick. So this is like coming into the real world. It's all right to be sick. And it's even all right. I was talking to someone just recently who was just last night in Perth, and she had, she had Lyme disease. And I said, look, be proud you've got Lyme disease. Don't stigmatize it. Don't think there's something wrong with you. Don't think that, you know, that this, that somehow this life has dealt you a bad hand of cards. No. Care for your sickness. Even just realize this is who you are, this is part of life, be it. That's why the Buddha always said, the body can be sick, but don't let the mind be sick. Just allow it to be. And number one, straight away, the sickness actually usually alleviates really quickly when you stop fighting it. Every year over in Western Australia, I've been looking after the Cancer Support Association over there, the Cancer Wellness Association. And I was reminded, for the last 25, 26 years I've been looking after that place. So much so that the West Australian State Government, they built them a new big campus, like a one-stop shop with the Melanoma Society, Breast Cancer Society, support, all the support groups, just in one place. So the government put about $6 or $7 million into rebuilding this campus. And so I had the big opening ceremony with the Premier and me. We were the two honored guests. I said, why did you invite me? There's no Christians or Muslims or anybody else here. Why me? And they said, because you know, you've been helping this place for 25, 26 years, coming to teach meditation, to give some good advice, and it works. And they gave me this wonderful example of some of the good advice which really, really worked. Because there was a, this is not with sicknesses and cancers. No, to embrace them and be with them instead of fighting them all the time. And they said there was one woman, she had a bad cancer, had the treatment, was in remission. She got into remission, wonderful thing. But as soon as she was in remission, she still wasn't free because she had this fear. What if it comes back? And of course, you know, it was a very unpleasant treatment. You know, those days, radiation chemotherapy, nowhere near as refined as it is today. It was very tough. And she was terrified. What happens if it would come back? So much so that, you know, all the psychologists, the counselors in that organization, they couldn't get anywhere with her. And then this bald-headed brown robe freak comes along and gives a talk and straight away solves the problem. And I said, what did I do? He said, so simple. Just, you know, one sentence changed her whole attitude. And it was actually a story, but the sentence in the end was what changed her. It was a story of, one of my stories, of one of the greatest English philosophers of the last century. I don't know if any of you know philosophy at all, but this philosopher was absolutely brilliant. I really admire him. And I learned him, I studied him when I was in Cambridge. And that was this great philosopher called Winnie the Pooh. Real philosophers, even children, can understand them. So this particular philosopher, Winnie the Pooh, he was walking with his best friend, Little Piglet, through the forest one day. Now, I think everybody knows those characters. Winnie the Pooh, never been to school, just likes his food. He's also fat and happy, just like someone you know very well. I am the monastic version of Winnie the Pooh. Same size. And he's got his little friend, Little Piglet. And Piglet is really small. And like many small people, they get very paranoid sometimes. And they get very scared. So, they were walking through the forest, a long way from home, when there was a storm. I heard you had a storm in Melbourne a couple of days ago. You know what a storm is like? Really strong winds, lashing rain, the trees swaying back, and sometimes the trees falling down. Did you get any storm damage in Melbourne a few days ago, trees coming down? Well, your fences as well. You know how dangerous it is. So they were alone in the forest, a long way from home, when the storm hit. and the trees were swaying, and a bang as the branches came off. If any of you ever do any public speaking, never talk in monotone. Every now and again, bang! To get people awake. To make it exciting. I've got no other sort of visual aids or things or music, but at least I can make up some loud noise. Bang! As a tree came down. And little Piglet, he was holding the paw of Winnie the Pooh, tighter and tighter and tighter, squeezing it, as you do when you're afraid. And he got so tight, and little Piglet looked at his best friend, Winnie the Pooh, in the eyes, you know, with absolute fear, and said, look, I can't go on. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? And that was a possibility. It wasn't fantasy, that was a real chance. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? They'd be crushed to death. There'd be no escape. They couldn't ring 000. Winnie the Pooh didn't have a smartphone. So, what would they do? And for 1 second, Winnie the Pooh was afraid. Just for 1 second. And the wisdom born of silence, because that's Winnie the Pooh, that was his great trick, like my trick. He said he didn't think very much. That's why he was so wise. So, Winnie the Pooh replied straight away with the wisdom from silence. He said, what would happen if a tree did not fall when we were underneath it? Problem solved. Because all fear is looking into the future with a negative mind. What would happen if something bad happened? And of course, that's a possibility. But that creates fear and terror. And usually, that helps bring about what you're afraid of happening. It actually increases the chances of what you're afraid of actually occurring. And the solution, so simple, what would happen if a tree didn't fall when we were underneath it, which is also a possibility, actually a much greater possibility. And it also gives you hope. Takes away the fear and brings you this positive message, what would happen if it didn't, which is more probable. And when you feel it's not going to happen, it usually doesn't happen. You're not even thinking about it. So you just walk through and usually find nothing adverse happens to you. And so I told that story, and this lady got it straight away. All the time she'd been thinking, what would happen if the cancer came back? And she got the message, what would happen if the cancer didn't come back? And 25 years later it hadn't come back, but she comes back every year to see me. She comes back, but not the cancer. And that was the solution for it. And so that's why, you know, I go to these places, and the head of the group, who I've known for a long time, a really good friend, now twice he asked me the question with cancer. He said, what do you think about all these people who fight cancer? And I said, look, quite frankly, I don't know what the experts say. As a meditating monk who knows the connection between the mind and the body, I think that's the last thing you should do, to fight things. The stress is what's caused this cancer usually in the first place. And adding more stress is just going to make matters worse. Just relax, be kind, but don't fight, for goodness sake. And he just smiled and said, thank you for so much. I've been looking after this group for such a long time, counseling people, having so much experience. And he said, this is what I found through experience, exactly what you said. Don't fight these things. Be there. Don't stigmatize it. Don't be afraid. Just allow it to be. And then it vanishes. If you have a Lyme's disease, if you have schizophrenia, whatever else you have, why do we stigmatize these things and try and get rid of them so much? It usually ends up making them worse. I try and keep up with modern therapies, and people are saying they have, I forget what it's called, the Finnish approach to schizophrenia or something, where if a person does have that terrible disease of schizophrenia, instead of actually denying it, they try and acknowledge the world of the schizophrenic. To actually to say, you know, that this is your world, this is your reality, and it's as valid as my reality. And when you validate, you know, what to us may be just a crazy, crazy scenarios, and you say, well, that's your reality, this is my reality, they're different, but yours is as valid as mine. Apparently it's a great result in them actually just lessening their fear and their struggle, their fighting against their delusions. And they get much, much better results afterwards. Can actually be more at peace with themselves, and the schizophrenic episodes actually lessen in their intensity. Brilliant solution. Validating something in another person which I cannot understand in myself. So there's lots of stuff like that, the wisdom born of silence, and it all comes from, again, take away the stigmatizing things and realizing there's so many different realities which we can accept and understand. But last night I told an interesting story, you know, from silence, just how, you know, we want to be wise, we want to find the truth, especially if you're like a Buddhist. There's many types of Buddhism. Which is the right one? Is it Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism? Which is the right one? Ajahn Brahm's type of Buddhism or some other Ajahn's type of Buddhism? Which is the right one? How do you know? How can you be absolutely sure? Is all Buddhism fake? Is Christianity right? Is Islam right? Is some other things right? How can we actually know what's right and what's wrong? And you've got to be very careful, because you all think you're right. The problem is that sometimes that once we have an idea we're right, then we think in that line and it just justifies itself. This particular experiment, which, you know, I'd said last night, but it's a great little story. You wouldn't have heard it here because I heard it from my friend, Professor Bernard Carr. He was just retired from Queen Mary College in London. He's a professor of theoretical physics as well, a student of Stephen Hawking's. He's also a Buddhist, my first Buddhist I ever met. We were at Cambridge together. But he's also, together, we were in the Society for Psychic Research in Cambridge. So we go ghost hunting together. You go to all these old houses. You know, we're students, it's great fun. If we heard there was a ghost somewhere, we'd, you know, get permission and go and stay up with it all night, see if we can find something. So we're all both interested in the same things, like ghosts, Buddhism, and science. And actually, I'm not sure how many of you that were last night at the university, but I told a ghost story last night, and I haven't told this one before yet. Do you want to hear the ghost story? I knew you'd say yes, but I wanted to ask you first of all. About this Australian woman. This Australian woman, she was visiting England on holiday. And like many people, if you go to, you know, England, one of the places you like to visit, the old castles. Now, they've been there for hundreds of years. And many of them are really spooky. They're dark, they're cold, and just, you know, the stones. Even when you walk, you know, the sound of your feet just echoes along these long, spooky corridors. And there's always these turns, you don't know what's around the corner. And many, many bad things that happened in those castles. You know, torture, dungeons, people being murdered. These terrible things have happened in those castles. And they're really, really, really creepy. And so she was given this tour around this castle by this old guy. And when she finished the tour, she was, you know, really on edge because the whole atmosphere was really, really spooky. And so she asked this man, "Have you ever seen a ghost in this castle?" And the man replied, "Madam, I've never ever seen a ghost in this castle. All the time I've lived here," he said, "I've never seen a ghost." And she said, "How long have you lived here?" And he said, 300 years. Ah! But anyway, we used to go hunting ghosts together. And so, but he told me that, you know, it's a scientist. He wants to put all these things in a very, very good experimental data, photographs, stuff like that. Give it some evidence base. But anyway, he told me this great experiment which was done on how we can't trust our thoughts and how sometimes we may think we're right but we're wrong. The experiment of the flower pot. So this was done in Imperial College in London, which is a very well-known scientific institution. And there, the experimenter, a well-known professor, invited his other friends and associates, professors, research scientists, and I don't think there was hardly any students, apparently, no, because he was going to do an amazing experiment of levitation. And this fellow was so well regarded, he got all these crusty old professors, research fellows, people who spend their whole life experimenting in science, to attend. And in the lecture theatre, on the big table in front, he brought in an ordinary flower pot, with some earth in it and the flower coming out. And he showed it to people. There was no strings, no wires, just a flower pot. And he placed it on the middle of the table. And he had cameras running, so, to prove that if it did levitate, it actually did. And he said, I'm now going to levitate this flower pot in front of you all, scientists, trained observers. And he said, but I need to get some help from you. And this help I need is to get some ambience. I want you to all start chanting in your own way, the old Indian chant of Om. The Om, Om, Om. And had all these old professors chanting Om. The fact he did that was a miracle because they trusted him, and so they thought, why not? So as they were all chanting Om, the flower pot rose in the air. It actually happened. He actually levitated in public, in front of trained scientists, a flower pot. Amazing. Not in sort of some weird place, in the Imperial College in London. It happened. He levitated it. Now, there were several of those scientists, trained observers, when interviewed afterwards, were adamant it never lifted above the table. It never rose. Nothing happened. It was on the table all the time. Even though the evidence was there. It was on camera, photographed. Everyone, well not everyone, but many people saw it rose. But they could not see it rise. Now to go back a little bit, what was actually happening, there was a huge electromagnet installed underneath the desk. And the ohm was there to mask the hum of the high current going through that. Which had given the game away straight away. It was like a fake, it was a trick, levitating a flower pot using electromagnetism. But that was not the point. The point of the experiment was, because people's views were so strong that this could not happen, it could not be happening. It was against everything they've ever believed and learnt and trained in. They literally could not see it. Literally, it was blocked from their consciousness. Their awareness did not register a flower pot rising. And I thought that was a great experiment to have done. Powerful. And that was the whole point of it. So, all that you believe, is it true? Or is it like you? Our views can be so strong that if a flower pot rises in the air, you just literally cannot see it. You're blind to it. It's right there in front of your eyes, but it doesn't register in your brain. Denial. That is why the problem of our modern world is because of thinking we block out much of reality. If we were silent, we're putting all our thoughts aside, then we would see that flower pot every time. It's the thoughts. It can't be happening. It isn't happening. This isn't a tumor in my breast. This isn't a pain in my left side, signs of heart attacks. This isn't happening because we block it out, because we are so negative to the truth. We're so afraid of it, we cannot see it. That is a big problem in our life. So, there's a big deficit in the economy. But Mr. Turnbull can't see it. Neither can Mr. Shaw. I'm a mug, I can see it. This is a problem when people think too much, they see so little. And they understand so little. That's why silence is the most amazing thing to become wise from. So, that's why we do meditate. That's why many professors get some of their best insights when they're not thinking about it. So people say, okay, I've got all these problems to solve in life, all these decisions to make. How in a practical way can we actually make those decisions, you know, from a place like silence? It's so easy to do. That's how I make my decisions, why I've been running successful monasteries for the last few years. All I do, I program in the information, get as much evidence as I possibly can, learn, you know, what the Buddha said, learn the science, get all the information, put it in, and then forget about it. Be silent. The last thing I do is keep thinking about it, because I know the more I think about it, the less I will ever find any solution. Just like that old method, if you can't remember somebody's name. Apparently that's why, you know, when you've been married for a long time, you always call your wife darling, because you can't remember her real name. So, anyway, so if your husband keeps calling you darling, so what's my real name? It's darling. Anyway, so if you try to remember a name, the more you think about it, the less likely it is to come up. But if you can be silent, it comes up pretty quickly. You ever notice that? Because you need to give your brain, your mind, a chance to work. And that's what happens with silence. Otherwise, you're blocking it out all the time. So if I have a problem to make, a problem to solve, put all the information in and then leave it alone. And let it just go through the system. And it always works, then just an idea comes up, and it's a really beautiful idea, a great solution to a difficult problem. And they all come from silence, not from other things. And of course, the biggest problem of the whole world, how to be happy. And a lot of times people keep thinking about how to be happy. They keep thinking about meditating. They keep thinking about volunteering for the BSV. Stop thinking about it and then you'll do it. Because when we're thinking, we can find all the wrong reasons for doing things. But when we're silent, it becomes so obvious that this is a great thing to do. Thinking is what blocks the truth. Some years ago, somebody asked me very quickly, give me some Dhamma. And it was actually members of the British Army who were Buddhists. Fascinating to go to places I'd never been for, to see there were Buddhists in the British Army, frontline troops. Not just support troops. It's amazing. And they were really good Buddhists. And it actually changed my attitude towards, you know, even being in the army. And I was also, I don't know if she's here, but I got one email from Melbourne, and saying just how much she's appreciated all the talks I've given, and especially just, you know, the way of looking at life and meditation as well. And now, you know, she always shares some meditation time with her clients. She's a prostitute. And I thought, well done. I'm not going to stigmatize you for your trade, what you're doing. She's trying to do it in a good way, but after doing the service, she teaches a meditation for 10 minutes. And what a fascinating world we live in. Don't judge. Don't think. Respect. Anyway, that there, by the way, she didn't offer to do any dana. You guys, I know what you're thinking. So anyway, just learning how to be another side, you get this great wisdom which comes up and great understanding. That's where, you know, I get my stuff from. And you solve solutions, you solve problems in life this way. And actually, with these military people, you know, one of the Dharma very quickly, and I said, never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Never allow your learning, your knowledge, to stand in the way of truth. And afterwards, I kept saying that in universities. Because one of the problems with universities, especially, we're told what to believe. And we're given all the facts. Same with medicine as well. We're given all the facts, and we don't see beyond those. And a lot of time, senior medical practitioners, senior researchers in science have kept telling me that sometimes what they see in front of them goes against everything they've been taught. But they know that what's been taught to them is actually wrong, and they can actually see that this is the problem, this is the solution. And people who actually go against the book and actually treat people that way have great success. But unfortunately, we're afraid. I always remember when I was being taken to a retreat over in Sydney some years ago by a GP. Now, he had trained in Sydney. He trained in Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. And he told me that the head of department, the head of the medical school there, he welcomed everybody to the new intake of medical students. And in his opening address, he gave this wonderful, wonderful lecture. And the opening few sentences were this. Welcome to the new batch of students to this hospital medical school. And he said, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years is wrong. My problem is, I don't know which 50% it is. And I thought, what a great professor, scientist that was. Saying 50% of what we're going to teach you is wrong. And I cannot know which 50% it is. That's a scientist. That's someone who puts aside all their thinking, which is born of what you've been taught, your knowledge, to actually to see new things, to see them afresh, to actually to get real wisdom. And that's as true in Buddhism as it is in medicine. 50% of what you are thinking right now is wrong. Do you know which 50% it is? That's life. So we're willing to actually to see things anew every time. And the only way we can do that is to break that thinking pattern. Be silent. And incredible wisdom comes from that silence. Not the wisdom which you remember from monks like me. Not just repeating what somebody else taught you. But what you see in your own silent mind. Which can sometimes be counterintuitive. Can sometimes be totally against what you've been taught. Can be so crazy sometimes. But it's true and it works. And just one example of this, just to finish off. But always remember this. Example, a great one. I was in Kuala Lumpur giving some talks, and they asked me to see one woman who actually was not a member of this particular Buddhist group, because, you know, she had been through a great trauma, and the counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists had been unable to help her at all. And so they asked me, maybe a Buddhist monk can. I've never been trained in psychology or psychiatry, I've just been a meditator. And they asked me to try and give her a hand to her. So brought her into the room, and I didn't know what happened to her. And she described what had occurred to her, which was horrendous. She had been very, very brutally raped. Grossly so. And all the time she was telling me this disgusting tale, that I kept my mind silent, non-judging. And after she finished, I was more shocked than probably she was, the words which came out of my mouth, from silence. When she finished, she was looking at me, trembling. I, a man, a Buddhist monk, who never been raped anywhere close to that in my life, said to this woman, "You are so lucky to have been raped like that." And I heard me say that, because it came from silence. I thought, what have I just said? I just said that she was lucky to have been raped. That was a circuit breaker. I realized afterwards why I said that. And I looked at her and said, somehow I've seen through the silence that you are an incredibly strong woman, that you will find your way out of this terrible, terrible grief and pain. And then you will be able to do something which I will never be able to do. You'll be able to meet another woman, many other women, maybe even men who have been raped. And you'll be able to tell them, I know what you feel. More than that, more than empathy, you'll be able to hold their hand and say, not only do I know how you feel, I know the way out. Follow me, because you've done that. I haven't. I said, that's why I said you were lucky. Because now you have something which you're going to be very special for. Something which can do a huge service for all those women who have to endure that terrible, terrible experience. You're going to be able to lead them out where many other people can't. That's what I meant by saying you're so lucky. And she got it. It was one of those great experiences where, because of silence, I threw away everything I should be saying, everything I'd ever learned what to say when someone has been badly injured like that. All this idea of compassion, you poor thing, oh, I wish that hadn't happened to you, all that stuff went totally out the window in silence. And I saw it in a new way, and it worked. The circuit breaker she needed to actually to take that terrible, terrible experience and make a life out of it. A helpful, beautiful life. And that's what she's doing now. So, that's what I mean, the wisdom born of silence. It's powerful, it's great. And that's wonderful, great things about Buddhism, you're allowed to do that. The dogma goes out the window. Silence allows you to see things in totally new ways. Da da da. Thank you for listening. Okay, so now we have the Buddha Puja. Shall we just have one question and the Buddha Puja? Because I should have finished it. Any have any questions about that, what I've just been saying? Going. Yee, gone. Okay, so we now have the Buddha Puja. So the kid's going to come in?
They're still getting ready.
Okay, so have a quick...
time, maybe we've got one of, you know, some questions.
Questions or comments? Very good. Oh, of course, but what do you treat it with?
For this era.
But there's also the caring for it. And take away especially the aggression and even the metaphor of doing battle with the cancer. That metaphor creates a mental state of fighting the corresponding stress which comes with such an attitude. Yes, treat it, but treat it kindly, softly, gently, with things.
Yeah. Sorry, it's the person who has to accept it, and that person is the one who has
to change their attitude to things in life, instead of fighting their way through life and doing battle with their career, battle with their family, battle with life, because that's what it's like. Some people, it's such a struggle. You're actually fighting like some street warrior through your life, your career, and all the problems which comes up. And you find that sometimes that can work sometimes. But oftentimes, especially with these sicknesses, it's the cause of the sickness, the stress which builds up after the years. And when you continue that stress, rather than changing your attitude and lifestyle, it really makes a difference. Somebody showed me a little YouTube video. Some really smart woman was wondering why people in stressful jobs, some have cardiac problems, others don't. What is the difference? Is it their diet? Is it their genetic disposition or what? And she finds it's none of those things. She identified that people who are in stressful jobs, whose attitude towards their job is just get through the day and get it done, who actually look at the stress with negativity, they're the ones who have cardiac problems. But those who look upon the stress as a challenge, something which is going to test them, they look in a positive way, they don't tend to get cardiac problems. What they were noticing, it's fascinating, it's not the stress of the job, it's the attitude you have. Because, you know, people are actually going to Rio for the Olympic Games. People who go in Australian Open, just down the corner in the tennis centres. They're at high stress, but they really enjoy it. It's a challenge. They're really going to go in there and do their best, but they don't have this great worry. They're the ones who achieve, but they don't have any physical bad effects. The attitude, is, they said, was the most important. Same with cancer. Mental attitude is an important part of the treatment. Not negativity, but a positive mind. Does that answer the question? Okay, very good.